Before we begin today's episode, it's really important for us to try and take the time and space to contextualize our conversations within the colonial and imperial projects that dictate power relations from the global to the interpersonal levels. This podcast is inherently an anti-state, anti-colonial, and anti-capitalist project, where we center radical love as a methodology or an approach to caring for and changing our world by making meaningful connections with each other. So, I'm Maha, and I'm currently based in Cataraqui or Kingston, Ontario by its colonial name, which is part of the traditional territories of the Anishinaabeg Nation and Haudenosaunee Confederacy. While we feature guests from across Turtle Island and across the world, this podcast is primarily recorded and produced in Cataraqui. As a queer, racialized, formerly international student, because I graduated, and now migrant based where I am, I want to take this opportunity to not just say a land acknowledgement for the sake of it, but to encourage folks who are similarly located, or who aren't similarly located, to be honest, to bear in mind our positionalities, or the ways in which we are socially and politically positioned to relate to power in its various forms, and therefore to consider our responsibilities to the earth, to non-beings and beings, and especially to Indigenous and Black Indigenous folks, by working against land dispossession and the violence of colonialism, capitalism, white supremacy, and more on Turtle Island. This also necessitates a transnational politic of extending this solidarity to struggles for land and dignity across the earth. I know that I owe a great deal to the Indigenous peoples of Turtle Island to be able to be present here, resisting colonialism in our connections of solidarity with one another. These connections bring me hope, a powerful tool indeed, for building futures of love and care that truly work for us all. It is through collective action and community care that we work to dismantle the systems that continue to impose white supremacist violence and work to center Indigenous sovereignty in our struggles for collective liberation. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Queer Muslim Resistance, a podcast from OPIRG Kingston. My name is Maha, and I'm one of your co-hosts, and I guess your producer too, which is kind of fun. And I'm really excited to bring back the podcast after a little break, a long break, so thank you for your patience. It's been a time, but now I'm out of school, so that's really fun. Today, I have a conversation with Elias, where we talk about artivism, sex education, mutual aid, and turning outdoor gatherings and protests into queer masjids on the go. In the second kind of section of this episode, Taylor joins me for a debrief on the conversation that I had with Elias, as normally we do have Nicole, but she was not able to join us today, but that is okay, because we still have some great conversations. So please do tune in. And quickly, before I let you listen to the rest of the episode, the Faith Not Fear Fund that Elias mentions, though they said it was specifically for Ramadan, or at the time we recorded, it was, you know, Ramadan time, the Faith Not Fear Fund is available all year round if you are looking to contribute some money there. Awesome! Now let's get started.
Hello, Maha, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
I know I asked already, but here we go, sorry.
No, okay. How are you?
I'm doing fine, alhamdulillah.
Awesome. So let's start off with the basics. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? So your pronouns, your background, where you're based, and whatever else you'd like to share?
Sure. So my name is Elias Bodardobin. I am a biracial gender fuck, they, them pronouns only. I'm based out of Piscataway and Nacotchtank land, so DC. And I am an Amazigh Sunni Muslim. I do a lot of work around sex education. I'm an artist, so I do a little bit of vinyl cuts, photography, screen printing, things like that.
Awesome. So what was your introduction to Islam like, and what sort of role has Islam played throughout your life?
Sure. So I was actually born Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the child of a sheikh. And I would say that probably while I was growing up, it was definitely used as a tool of like control and abuse. My father was definitely very strict. And it wasn't until I was put into Islamic school through the years of like, I want to say sixth to maybe ninth grade, and then also 12th grade, where I was put into Islamic school. And during that time, I had a Quran teacher who like really made me love the religion. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that probably just came because I was looking probably for like an adult figure to treat me in a good way.
Yeah.
And so I feel like my Quran teacher at the time like really told me that like I could be good, or like really like was very supportive in certain ways. Like was always like doting on me, or like expressing how much she enjoyed my presence, or how much she enjoyed that I was like quick to pick up on concepts or things of that sort. And that like was a really big deal to someone like me who had like undergone a lot of childhood trauma and like needed to hear words of affirmation. Unfortunately, she was like pretty homophobic up until like her last breath. You know, Allah yarhamha, she's passed now. But if I hadn't, you know, crossed paths with her, I'm not sure I would have stuck with the religion.
Mm-hmm.
In the way, that I currently, you know, do or am sticking with it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that also just like leaving the community, the Houston community, and like moving out to DC was like really helpful for me in order to like expand my understanding of the religion and kind of like grow in the ways that I needed to, and like feel more comfortable in my own practice and like make it my own, if that makes sense.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I love that your teacher, your Quran teacher, was a wonderful support for you growing up. And it's a shame that they were homophobic. But I still think there's so many different ways that people can be important to us and like instill the values of Islam in us without necessarily always centering queerness. So I think that's really lovely. But how does Islam act as a guide or a framework to the ways in which you practice and think about restorative justice?
Sure. So I think that restorative justice, transformative justice, like those frameworks are very present in the kind of bedrock of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most obvious one to come to mind is going to be like Hadith al-Nawawi, like number 34, which is like, if it's like, I don't know, like if reading it in Arabic is going to like make sense to you, so I could just like read it in English, but basically it's a hadith which says like, on the authority of Abu Sa'id al-Khudri, I heard the Messenger of Allah say, whosoever of you sees an evil, you know, let him change it with his hand. And if he is not able to do so, then let him change it with his tongue. And if he is not able to do so, then within his heart. And that is the weakest of faith, right? Mm-hmm. And so I feel like that is like a very clear basis for like, if you see an injustice, it is your duty as a Muslim to stop it or to stand with the oppressed instead of with the oppressor. Because as we know, not saying anything or like not doing anything is taking the side of the oppressor.
Mm-hmm.
There's also just like verses in the Quran that like say similar things. One of the most famous ones is going to be Surah Baqarah verse 30. Which is basically talking about like making humans as the Khalifa on earth. And that's of like a very specific understanding and framework as well. And like the angels were like, what are you talking about, God? You're going to make humans that are going to like fight each other and like not sanctify you and whatever, what have you. And Allah was like, I know that which you don't know. And so obviously there is some, we are building towards some sort of future where we are the stewards of the earth to some degree. And I don't think that, you know, the Khalifa just mean Muslims, though like part of being a good Muslim is, you know, being the steward of the earth and taking care of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like those stand out very clearly in the framework. Examples of like just the way that the Prophet like deals justice to people and gives them alternatives. And also somebody that I really admire, Delia, does a lot of work with fruitful futures and transformative justice and restorative justice in Islam. And one of the resources they shared with me as like restorative justice and Islam theory and practice, which is by Nawal H. Ammar. And so like that framework and like reading that chapter of restorative justice in Islam kind of like goes through like the very deep processes or like explanation of like Sharia and like the way that certain crimes like the hudud crimes are like handled, and how even in the most severe crimes there's usually an alternative penalty, quote unquote, available, especially when it like comes to crimes against man. Then, you know, there's that option of like, do you want to, you know, do an eye for an eye, or would you rather have blood money, things of that sort. Mm-hmm. Whereas kind of crimes against God are a little bit more severe. Mm-hmm. So like it kind of breaks it down and like shows that the beginning stages of restorative justice are present and how we can like build within that. So that was also a very helpful resource that like helped me begin to understand the ways that this framework is being thought about and is present in the religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that resource. We'll definitely link it in the episode description. So do you mind actually explaining a little bit about transformative and restorative justice, just for folks who might not have the understanding of that?
Sure. So restorative justice and transformative justice is kind of a framework that basically maintains that, you know, cancel culture is something that like to some degree is necessary, but more so of like a call-in culture, hopefully, ideally, that everybody kind of deserves rehabilitation, that everybody is not like everybody has inherent value. Nobody should be cut off or removed from access to just basic human, you know, dignity, like resources, access to shelter, food, community, things of that sort. And restorative justice is kind of the process that allows people who have maybe enacted harm on others in the community to kind of still be in community with, you know, other folks. And so I think that it's really important that we are doing what we can to build that framework in our community so that people who do fall through the cracks don't as much. And it's definitely that I feel like it's a little bit more of like a hot button topic or something that's being talked about more and more nowadays, because it's, I guess, like not cool, but like it is something that is taking more center stage and more folks are talking about it, and more folks are kind of looking back at the work that's already been done on it, because of course this work has been going on for years and years in communities, right? I hope that was clear.
So you're an artivist and a sex educator. Tell me more about the work that you do.
Sure. So I use the word artivist just because I feel like art doesn't really exist outside of activism, in that like if your art is not making folks uncomfortable or making people in power uncomfortable, then you're basically just a tool of the oppressed class, and you're just making art for people to feel kind of content and happy, which is to some degree like everybody wants to create art that makes them happy and content. Mm-hmm. But to some degree, if like that's all you're doing and you're not really engaging in kind of deep thinking or kind of the ways that, you know, your art is being perceived, or the way that, you know, just in general, how identities interact with one another, then, you know, I feel like you're missing a little bit of your duty as somebody who is creating discourse in society. Mm-hmm. So I also do work with sex education. It was something that like I was very passionate about when I was in undergrad, and at the time like no one was really talking about it, and it was just something that was like really frustrating for me, that like I could see the lack in our communities. I knew like people who I had gone to college with who like didn't know that they peed out of this like a different hole than they bled out of, and so just like very common things that I was like, this is not okay. And recently, I feel like there's been some changes, right? Obviously, like now we have apartment and girls, now we have like other things. I think it's for youth, people, you know, people doing good things in kind of those veins. But I feel like when I was in undergrad, those options were not available. Like the degrees that are now available, like people getting like degrees in sexual education or like public health in like specific like veins was not really something that was widely done or accessible when I was in undergrad. So I feel like my experience with sex education has been more of just kind of workshops and like one-offs here and there. But it is something that I'm still very passionate about, and I would love to like make myself bigger in that field, like in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome. So what does community building look like and feel like to you?
Sure. So community building, I feel like, has a lot to do with showing up and mutual aid, which again, like you can take from Islam and the history of Islam. Like one of the very basic tenets of Islam is zakat, which I feel like is a very large form of mutual aid. And people, like, I feel like when you're asking people for examples of restorative justice or transformative justice in the community, people like always sometimes overlook zakat because they're like, oh, well, that's just like a part of Islam, or like it's like one of the five pillars. But like when you think about it, or when you like really like realize where that need comes from, like the most easiest way to affect communities is to put like capital directly into the communities that are affected or that have been kind of suppressed for a long time, or that like there is a large gap in between. So like I feel as though Zika has like a really large part of mutual aid, and while some of us can't always afford to do Zika in like ways that we'd like, I feel like especially since the pandemic has begun, like budgeting a certain amount per month to put towards folks in your community, like local community, folks of color, folks who need it, trans women, anybody who like really in is struggling in your community, I feel like setting funds aside and like redistributing your wealth is really important. And that's something, you know, that I've been working on. And community building, I feel like also can be seen in like that inauthentic story that like everybody loves to circulate of like the prophet who had this woman who would like dump garbage on his fucking doorstep or whatever. I don't know if I'm allowed to curse. Sorry. Would like just put trash all over his doorstep whenever he left his home, and then like one day it wasn't there and he like grew concerned and went to go see her, and she was sick or whatever and was so touched that he visited that she became Muslim. Now a lot of chefs are going to tell you that it's inauthentic, right? I have a very different approach to how stories and how like hadith are circulated. I'm not so sold on like what's da'if and what's not. I do tend to like pick my hadiths and like what I want to believe. And while this one like doesn't have a chain of narration, I really don't care, because obviously something like it has surpassed enough centuries and people have circulated it orally for enough for it to be like a very common like story. And even if it like never really occurred, I think that that sentiment is very important, that, you know, even if somebody has at one point caused you harm, still checking in on them and bringing them into the community in the long run can be good for your, for the community as a whole. Something that like I work on is like creating space for people, and I think that is really important for community building, as well as making sure folks have the space to show up and like have healing journeys together, or like support one another in those journeys. And so my friends and I, basically, like me and two other folks, founded the Halal and Queer Collective, which is like a DMV-based queer Muslim group focused on healing justice and like the ways that queer Muslims in the DMV area have been kind of like the struggles that we face, and like making space for that community to heal and kind of support each other through whatever it is that we're going through. And so that's something that I'm really passionate about, is like continuing to create spaces for queer Muslims, because I didn't have those spaces growing up, or was policed out of spaces that like weren't Muslim specific, or was like pushed out of spaces that were not fully like comprehensive of all identities. And so whenever there's a lack, you end up being the one creating. Mm-hmm. And so I think, for me, community building is like really about making those spaces, supporting one another, redistributing wealth, seeing needs in the community and matching them, right? So I feel like that's like the most important part of it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. That was a lovely answer. And in our previous correspondence, you said that justice is about power to all the people, and that includes those outside of our immediate intersecting identities. So what does the concept of queer Muslim resistance mean to you?
That's a very important question. And I was like thinking about it a lot when I was looking over the questions. I think what resistance looks like to me, it changes, I think, on a day-to-day basis. I think some days it looks like survival, but other days it looks like thriving. I think that for the most part, queering, quote unquote, queering the discourse, or like queering kind of the tenets or like the very basic foundation of Islam is like important for the community to like reclaim kind of the religious trauma that's been enacted on them. And so I feel like queer Muslim resistance has a lot to do with like finding what part of the religion works for you. And again, not cherry picking, because like, I really don't really like that term, but mm-hmm. also like 100% like cherry picking is valid, because like the average Muslim is not spending hours memorizing fiqh or studying fiqh or like knowing the chain of narrations or like knowing which person narrated what and what that person's lineage is, or maybe that one time that person, you know, uttered an unkind word and so now all of their hadith are drawn into question or what have you. And so I feel as though, you know, what resonates with you and what matches your understanding of how Allah's mercy and compassion exists in the world is what's important. And if, you know, you see a hadith that doesn't really match your concept of God or of the way that you practice Islam, then, you know, just leave it and, you know, continue on your way. And so I feel like that is the most like validating part of queer Muslim resistance, is just like taking what works for you.
Mm-hmm. I love that that concept of like centering hadiths that work for you and leaving the ones that don't. Someone very wise once told me that if you're not sure about whether to like take on board a hadith, does it center the compassion and mercy of God? If so, then you can consider it. If not, then you are free to leave it. So I think that that's kind of helped me in my own process of trying to figure out like what works for me. So
I just, absolutely.
Yeah. We talk a lot about collective healing on this podcast. So how does seeking ancestral joy help ground the ways that you heal in community?
Absolutely. So I think doing ancestor work is really important to kind of understanding yourself and also understanding kind of your place in the world. I think that a lot of people focus on like ancestral trauma a lot, and kind of like, oh, this has been passed down, you know, through genetics, through whatever. And it's something that like really deeply resonates. And I think that that's accurate, like 100%, like we all have ancestral trauma, right? Like I know that I have ancestral trauma, but when it comes down to it, I feel like focusing on things that bring you joy or things that you feel like your ancestors would have enjoyed or things that you feel like your ancestors took joy in. So for me specifically, that's right now that's showing up in like, mutual aid efforts, in actions in the community. And so even if those actions aren't specifically like Muslim, but just showing up for protests, showing up for basically things that are happening in the community that are important to the like social society, I would just say. I'm trying to be like vague without like, please, Daddy Facebook, don't like, I was never at these things. I was never present at these actions. But just in general, you know what I mean? Like, I feel as though, for me specifically, I feel like the protest has kind of replaced the concept of the masjid, because masjids are not welcoming to queer people. And when they are, they're not always like solid physical spaces. Of course, like the ones that, you know, we're aware of, Masjid al-Rabia, like I'm on the board of Masjid al-Rabia, that's a queer masjid in Chicago. And then I think there was one in DC for a short time ran by Imam Da'i, but that, like, don't know what happened to it, disappeared or whatever, what have you. And so like my long-term dream would like love to be like building a masjid here in DC for like queer Muslims to be able to congregate to, right? But right now that's not always a possibility. And so if you were to go to a mainstream masjid, you would be policed out, especially if, you know, you're trans, non-binary, and you're clearly not passing or not fitting in one or the other, you're not going to have a good experience in the masjid. And so I feel like definitely the protest has kind of taken that role of like, when I go to an action or when I go to a protest, I'm seeing community, I'm interacting with people that I respect and I love, we're having conversations, we're doing work that brings joy. And I think that that is something that my ancestors would, you know, take joy in and are joyful for me. That is something that I'm taking part in. But also aside from like doing that work, you do also want to have rest, because that is also a large part of ancestral joy, right? Of like your one of your ancestors, probably like wildest dreams was to probably rest so that they didn't have to like work so fucking much. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like tapping into what you feel brought, you know, your ancestors, that kind of happiness and that kind of excitement and contentment, and then kind of building it in your own life.
Yeah, I love that a lot. Thank you for sharing. So there's two more questions left. What would you like any listening queer Muslims to take away from your stories, and anything you'd like to plug? Is there anything that you'd want to talk about that doesn't fit into those two questions that you would like to kind of bring up in the podcast?
So I don't really feel like I have like a whole lot of tips or things that I'd want like other queer Muslims to know. I think just like the main one is that like if you're young and queer, like if you are still living with your family, or if you're still like not quite out and you're not quite safe to be out, I just feel like it's very always important to like emphasize that you don't have to be out, and you should like definitely take what measures you can to make sure you're financially stable or like you have a support system in place if you are intending to come out, just because I feel as much progress has been made, like queer Muslims weren't even like a visible thing when I was like 16, 17, right? And now like over a decade later, like I feel like the queer Muslim master post that I started on tumblr.com has like now been circulated to several different websites. I have people like reaching out to me, like asking to put it on their progressive Muslim website, or, you know, this, that, or the third. And so I haven't updated it in over a year, or like probably 2 years, honestly, by this point. So I'm glad that it's still like circulating and helping people, but really when it comes down to it, if you are a queer Muslim and you're young and you don't have that kind of support system built yet, it sucks. And so I really just want them to know that, like, inshallah, like if you can keep yourself safe until you're able to get to a point where you have that support system and are able to get out of that situation, to not out yourself before you're ready, or to protect yourself until you're ready. And it's okay if you're never ready also, because I feel like that's also something that people are like, well, everything is eventually building towards coming out. And that's just not, you know, that's, I feel like, a very Western concept is not something that's going to be accessible to everybody, especially in our communities. I did want to talk a little bit about how I feel like Islam is inherently anti-capitalist and inherently anti-racist, just from like the Prophet's last sermon and like the emphasis that was put on like interest and the emphasis that was put on race in the last sermon. I feel like people tend to overlook it or tend to oversimplify it of like, oh, well, the Prophet said like a black man is just as important as a white man, or like no Arab is better than a non-Arab. And so like there's no race problem in Islam, of course. And we all know that that's not accurate, that anti-blackness has affected a lot of our communities. And so it's really important that as queer Muslims, even though our struggles are very unique and very real and valid, you know, if you're seeking asylum from a country that's going through, you know, war, if you are dealing with the caste kind of system and kind of like where you fall in that, if you're dealing with just anything in general, I feel like people tend to get wrapped up in their own kind of trauma and their own kind of basically their own kind of like identity politics. But when it comes down to it, anti-blackness is still going to be prevalent in those communities. And I think what the Prophet was saying with the last sermon around race was specifically, I think like there couldn't be any other explanation for me, is that like the Prophet would comprehend that in this framework, it is important that this is said, because down the road, this is going to turn into a very big issue. And so I feel like the Prophet knew that, you know, what people have been, or like what I feel like community leaders have been saying for the past couple of years, which is like, you need to work bottom up. So you need to work with the most marginalized, which in this case would be Black trans women. And then once all of their rights and like all of their needs are met, then everybody else's will also be satisfied, if we are like truly, you know, addressing problems at the root, or like issues and like unequal or like things, like if we're focusing on reparations, like that's where we need to focus and then build up. And I think that's a large part of the Prophet's last sermon. And anybody who's like looking for restorative framework in Islam, I think that is also a very good place to start. Yeah.
So is there anything that you'd like to plug, and where can folks find you if you'd like them to find you?
Sure. So as the arts and education director of Meshel Rabia, I, of course, I'm going to plug the Meshel Rabia fundraiser, the Faith Not Fear Fund. We are hoping to gain a lot of funds during Ramadan specifically, because I feel like a lot of folks during Ramadan, that's where they like, oh, where should I put my zakah? So if you're wondering, if you would like some transformative, amazing places to put your zakat towards, definitely check that out. And then most folks can find me on any and all platforms using my username, which is Strawberry Eli. So it's like the word strawberry, except you subtract the Y and then just put the first three letters of my name. So that's on Twitter, on Tumblr, which I don't even really use that much anymore. Instagram, but yeah, so like most social media, it's going to be that username. I have a website. I don't really update it because I don't have the energy. It's a pandemic, but that website I can also drop here. They came out with the .gay recently, and I'm thinking of trying to rebrand to maybe hakalati.gay, but you know, URLs cost money, and I can't even find where my receipt for this URL is. So we'll see how that works.
Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been lovely chatting with you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you for letting me share my opinions and where folks can hopefully reach out, contact me, especially if you're a queer Muslim in the DMV and you want to get involved with the Halal and Queer Collective. Hit me up, let me know.
Hello and welcome to the debriefing section of Queer Muslim Resistance, a podcast from Oberg Kingston. Who are you?
Who am I?
Yeah, I'm Maha. I'm one of your hosts, and I do the introductions and outros to the podcast. And also, I have the conversation with our guest.
You're basically our leader. That's weird. I don't like that.
Okay. You're not a leader. Thanks. You're a follower. Okay, I'm sorry.
I'm trying to get away from that whole binary.
What did you think of Elias's episode, Taylor?
I thought it was, you know, it's so interesting to hear different queer Muslims say all the things that I'm like, yeah, this is where my brain is. It feels like we're all in the same space and time in terms of thinking. And it's exciting because it's like, I don't know you like that. I don't know you personally, but you're out there in the world doing good shit. And that's exciting for me because I'm like, there are other people, and it's not to say only people who think like me are doing good things, but people who have both my religious viewpoint as well as my social viewpoint and my political viewpoint and are putting those things into practice. And it's always so, so good to get people who make that explicit, that connection between religion and religious beliefs and practice so clear in terms of, you know, our politics, being radical, being resisting, really, like being radical and resisting. And I enjoyed it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. So thank you for asking.
Yeah.
What did you think? Did you have any thoughts?
Yeah. It was really great talking to them. I think one thing that I wanted to kind of talk about that you also sort of mentioned, Elias specifically said that, like, they want to and do partake in political actions that are, you know, not even, or even if they aren't, quote unquote, specifically Muslim. Mm-hmm. And, like, to me, that's kind of what queer Muslim resistance is, right? Like, we're not thinking about identity politics to this extent where, like, we're centering ourselves or centering only people who look like us or think like us or who have these more or less arbitrary similarities.
Right.
But, like, we're thinking about the doing and the thinking and the engaging with people and, like, engaging with the world and building relationships. Mm-hmm. We're thinking about all those things. And, like, what doing those things from your political site has the potential to disrupt, to destroy, to create, to rebuild, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I think that, you know, on a base level, most Muslims will agree that you don't have to be Muslim. Actually, the criteria for me being good to you is not that necessarily that you're Muslim, but that you're a person.
Mm-hmm.
And they can accept that, but it's hard to make meaningful connections and really act in solidarity with people who have differing views than you if it's not just, I'm not rude, you know, or I'm showing you base level kindness.
Mm-hmm.
I think even though we can, and when I say we, I think most Muslims can make the association that to be Muslim is to be good to human beings in general and to our environment and to God's creations, that goodness and action of goodness oftentimes doesn't move beyond surface level politeness and surface level advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
And what we are thinking about is not the fact that we are Muslim and therefore we need to be kind to people and good to everyone, but rather every single person is part of God's creation.
Exactly.
And part of that, knowing that as a Muslim, is the obligation to act in the most, as Elias said, the most fervent in faith is to do, is to change something with your hands. And if you can't do that, then you change it with you say something with your mouth. And if you can't do that, you say it with your heart. So really, we are all called to do the most at all times with everyone. And rather than, you know, politeness and kindness surface level, mm-hmm. and then choosing, okay, well, that's not my issue, or, you know, I don't agree with your politics, so, yeah. you know, I step back here, mm-hmm. type, you know, work. And so for us, it's easy to say this activism goes beyond being Muslim. Like, queer Muslim resistance is as much for all Muslims as it is for everyone else.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
Because as a Muslim, we see everyone else on that same basis of worthy of God's love, God's mercy, and thus worthy of my love, my mercy, my compassion, my mm-hmm. action, and I'm being called to act.
Yeah.
Right? So,
yeah, because it's about believing and acting intentionally with the belief that every single person is inherently valuable,
mm-hmm.
or I don't know if valuable is the right word, because, you know, we don't want to be
valuable because you were born, because yeah. God put you on the earth. You are a being, you were created,
yeah.
you are here, therefore you have value, like,
yeah.
period, you know.
Totally. And speaking of that idea of, like, a lot of people being reluctant, hesitant, fearful, doubtful, you know, when it comes to engaging in meaningful connections, meaningful relationships with folks who are different than you,
mm-hmm.
that kind of reminds me of this other thing that I was thinking about. So my wonderful supervisor of this podcast, when it first started off, and friend, said recently that, like, hashtag I exist narratives are ultimately about proving something to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just need to kind of reframe the way that we think about queer Muslim resistance to center what it means to, you know, feel joy and freedom in our bodies. And, like, what are those conditions that make us feel joy, that make not just us feel joy, but, like, it's like Elias said, like, working from the bottom up,
mm-hmm.
addressing those most marginalized and the issues, and addressing the issues that impact those who are most marginalized, I should say, you know?
Yeah, you work from the bottom up.
Yeah.
I like that. I think ultimately it's us thinking about queerness and the queer and queer Muslim resistance is not just, you know, an identity label, right? Mm. Like, not just something, you know, you pinpoint and say, this is who I am, but
mm-hmm.
rather something that focuses on the work that you do. And to do that work is to not just focus on I exist,
mm-hmm.
and rather what that existing necessitates,
yeah.
what it means you have to do,
what it means you have to disrupt and destroy,
exactly.
and rebuild and create, like I said earlier.
Exactly. And unfortunately, I think, but maybe quite fortunately, a lot of queer Muslims do that work and are able to find that work in communities that are not distinctly Muslim.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's so important.
Mm-hmm.
That's just so important, because we have to show up for people who aren't just like ourselves. Like, I remember, like, obviously I'm not like advocating, like, you know, we should all donate to every single charity we can. I mean, not all the charity's bad, but, like, I'm not trying to
yes.
say that, like, you know, zakat is bad, but I'm thinking about, like, redistribution of wealth and, like, actually tackling wealth systems, right? Rather
right.
than, like, donating.
Right.
And, like, donating also implies and has that, like, the power hierarchy, right?
Uh-huh.
Where it's, like, I'm doing something nice for you. Therefore, you know, there is some string attached.
Right.
Like,
right.
therefore, I can get a tax break or whatever the fuck.
Right. I think that, you know, this is quite interesting that you've mentioned this, because zakat is a pillar
yeah.
of Islam. But it is a pillar of Islam that I think, when I think of zakat, I think of the necessity of getting your hands dirty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you have to sacrifice something.
Yeah.
And so the sacrifice, I think, makes sense when it comes to money, because we live in a capitalist society,
mm-hmm.
and wealth accumulation is very close to power and the top hierarchies of
mm-hmm.
power and how that works for everyone else.
Yeah.
But it doesn't stop with money donation, you
no.
know, my annual money donation
no.
and that that is the sole requirement of me acting as a good Muslim. Like that, it really, truly, I personally think that Zakat, as much as it is, and I mean, I know this isn't radical or revolutionary because I've seen many, many Muslims on social media comment on how Zakat is not just the money that you, but the time and the work and effort that you can put in. And if you can't do that, then you give money. If you can't physically get your hands dirty, then you give money. If you can't suffer in a way to show how much you care, if you can't fast, then you give money, if that makes sense. Right? So
I think that
it's, and I really, really, really love that Elia said Islam is anti-capitalist, like baseline anti-capitalist, is because I lost my train of thought.
Islam is anti-capitalist because it criticizes, it critiques the accumulation of wealth, of greediness, of hoarding, of taking more than what you need. The reason that I brought up charity, I don't remember what line of thought I was thinking of at the time, but I was thinking just now that, or about this post by an Indigenous anarchist on Instagram that talks about mutual aid being just charity that allows tyranny to continue if you're not also working to to solve the problem at hand. So let me just read through this thread.
And this just, can you repeat the name of the page that it's on?
Oh, of course, The Indigenous Anarchist. When we give unhoused people socks and hand warmers instead of work to get them homes, we are missing the goal in order to perform the least difficult action. The result is continued suffering. We could instead give out hand warmers while we work towards getting people into homes. The Band-Aid action becomes part of change instead of an end itself. While it's a lot more pleasurable to get supplies from mutual aid organizations, opposed to charities, I assume, we have access to most of what is given away via social services as well. It's usually all they do, instead of provide actual services. See how this repeats? Social services refuse to house us or provide us with caseworkers or temporary stability. Then when mutual aid organizations do the same, it feels hopeless. As mutual aid focuses on supply distribution, the organizers cement themselves as housed and as giver, making the unhoused the recipient. This is the model we use for charity. It represents unequal power dynamics. Instead of organizing with the people in need, folks do whatever feels best to them as a housed person. This is dehumanizing and careless organizing. What we need is homes, not socks, tarps, and blankets. Effective models for housing people exist worldwide as to examples of actions that put pressure on local resources and politicians. It's not an unsolvable problem. Sitting on a city council member's lawn does more for us than giving us a burrito. If you were unhoused, would you want people who have bathrooms, showers, kitchens, support systems, and relative privilege to give you hand warmers that you could get at the Dollar Tree yourself with some change? Or would you want them to work with you to get you housed, or at least to put pressure on those blocking that solution? Mutual aid is not meant to be based on a charity model. It is supposed to be a way we give what we have to aid others with the understanding we're in the same position, with the understanding were we in the same position, others would aid us. So the reason that I think that relates to what we were talking about earlier is because we were talking about charity or like just kind of throwing money at something without having a meaningful engagement with people who are marginalized and facing issues that, you know, are brought about by capitalism, white supremacy, colonialism, etc. So like this post uses unhoused people as an example or kind of like a case scenario in which even mutual aid organizations aren't necessarily always doing something different.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm trying to think of the connection, and maybe it's because I'm still thinking about the cat, but I'm trying to think of the connection between charity, mutual aid, and like something that is more meaningful than that, that we can still, like, that you can, I'm still struggling to make that connection between not Islam and mutual aid, but the thought of zakat
as mutual aid?
No, zakat as something that can be more charity. You know, like, and I did say that, like, you're giving,
I think it's probably because zakat is the bare minimum, right? That's why it's a pillar.
Right, but I guess. So this thread just throwed me off because I was thinking on those lines, but it makes it hard to connect it to zakat, which is charity.
Maybe we should look up zakat as mutual aid and see what comes up. I'm going to do that right now.
But mutual aid, just like that thread just said, mutual aid doesn't always have to mean... Like that, anyway, I'm just saying that thread threw me off because it was talking about activism that's not just donation of things and goods.
It's working to solve the problem.
Yes, working to solve the problem. But how can you connect that to zakat?
What do you mean?
Like, arguably, zakat is the thing you shouldn't do, which is just giving. Right, like,
but that's the thing, it's the bare minimum, right? Like, you're not expected to just do the basic, like, you know, like, should you not be going above and beyond to, like, or not above and beyond, but, like, do you not want to try and work with the compassion, as close to the compassion and mercy of God as you can?
Right, so, you know, what you're saying makes sense. I just think that the thread was confusing because it straight up said, you know, giving isn't as good, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a bit challenging, I think, because you think giving with the intention of it doing good, right? It's maybe uncomplicated or uncritical giving.
Yeah, I think also because we're so used to the ways in which zakat is currently marketed to us, right? Like, we're a charity that will count towards your zakat. Like, everything is framed in a charity model.
Right.
Right? So, like, that makes it harder for us to kind of think about or conceptualize zakat outside of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? I think that's where some of
I think you're right on that. I think because it's so focused on your money, and you the idea is that you give your money to something that you care about, that's something that you think will do good, but ultimately the framework is hierarchical, right? Like, it's a hierarchical framework. I give you something that doesn't take that much out of me, won't significantly alter my functioning, my privilege, but I will hope in that giving that I do something, that it does something better for you. That's the thing that one would argue that article challenges in the framework of zakat. The difficulty is rethinking zakat still, and it's still incorporating the money aspect and the actual charity aspect, but thinking of it as something that still demands more meaningful and more radical forms of giving, like something that, which is why I'm.
Did you say more radical forms of giving?
Not giving, like giving of your time, you know, like not just money, right?
I think instead of giving, it would be engaging. I think that's a better framework to think about it.
Right? Engaging. Yeah, that is a better framework. Better ways of engaging with things. I like that.
Yeah.
I just think that the model of zakat right now makes it so that people can't actually and don't actually associate that radical work with
zakat.
Yeah. Right? Because it's like you're giving,
it's poverty porn, like, mail that we get being like, donate to these children and your zakat will be like you will get so much reward in heaven or whatever.
Right. And it's not, and again, it's not to say that money isn't helpful, because
no, because you are making, you know,
money is helpful, but it doesn't critique and doesn't do much to prevent the necessity of having to give money, you know, the necessity of having to constantly, if you're following the analogy of that, of the pulse that Maha was reading, the necessity of having to give blankets and leg warmers.
That just can't be all you're doing.
Right. So I was having a really hard time because I was like, you know, I'm thinking of Zakat and I'm thinking of it as exactly that.
Yeah.
It is charity. It's money that you're giving to someone else.
But that's just the way we've been, that's the way it's been marketed, legitimately marketed, so that people, certain charities and non-profit organizations can get our money.
And if we're trying to think in an anti-capitalist lens, perhaps we can propose or push a form of Zakat that doesn't require money, and instead requires that you do something that takes something out of you. So takes your time, takes your energy, takes your attention, takes your something that is meaningful, like a meaningful thing that you still have to give toward. And because I think that's the point of Zakat. It has to be something that you feel, right? Like the idea of giving your hard-earned money is you earned it.
Yeah. I think I agree with you, but I still want to reframe something.
Yeah.
I want to reframe the way we think about giving and taking.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I don't want, like, I personally don't see, like, it's all about mutuality, right? So mutual engagements with different people with,
but like, it can still be equitable, right?
Of
like,
course.
I give and I take.
Yeah.
Right? In the same way that you give and I and you take from me, right?
Yeah.
Because we're sharing, sharing what we we don't have.
Sure. I guess that sharing is what I like.
Right.
Right? It's that sharing.
Right. So sharing in activist space, activist work, meaningful work that is, and something the reason I use giving is because it has, I think for me to think about it as a cat, it has to be something that
uncomfortable, that makes you critique, that you feel,
it has to be something that it can't go unnoticed, it can't, I mean, those things are important too, but it has to be something that you are putting in your, it's like fasting, you know, like I think of it as like fasting, like you're doing this thing that is, you is not pleasant, and that's the point,
so
it is, you're giving something in a way, and that's to get something in return, and the
getting, and to get, you know, I don't know, to for others to get.
Yeah. I mean, your get would be spiritual blessings, like blessings from God.
Yeah.
You know, like you're giving, you're not giving to get a reward.
Yeah.
Earthly reward.
Oh, some people
get,
are though.
But well, I wouldn't call that. Are. Yeah. I wouldn't necessarily call that, you know,
Zakat.
you're giving to get a heavenly reward, but, the giving in itself needs to be a means to an end of a sort. And the end should always be, you know, the taking away of that injustice, that, you know, power imbalance, that necessity in you giving in this specific way.
Interesting that you say means to an end, because I was going to say a means to a mean. A means to a means, because I don't know if you can ever have a perfect utopia without injustice. It would
be reframing
or like working with each other to figure out how to interact with each other, not anew, but differently.
And because change, right? Like it will constantly, you know, we're constantly working to make our lives more equitable.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I agree with you. I don't know if we'll necessarily meet a place, that utopian place, but sometimes I like to dream.
No, for sure.
I like to hope.
And my whole master's project was on, you know, what's his name? Jose Esteban Munoz's Cruising Utopia. It's a very good read. I mean, okay, no, it was very challenging.
It's an academic read.
It's a very academic read. And I was like, I have no idea what's going on most of the time. But it did inform a lot of my work in critical thinking, because Munoz talks about, I'm sure I've mentioned this on the podcast
too.
I'm
pretty sure you have,
like, a billion times, probably. Sorry for anyone listening, but that whole idea of, like, you can't exist in queerness because queerness is in the futures realm, because it's not something you can actively embody. It's about reaching towards something so that you're always working to try and get to somewhere, but you're not getting anywhere, if that makes sense. So I think that's kind of, I think that's what I'm trying to say as well, though, in terms of the means to a means. There is no end. But you think about an end to, I guess that's a means to a means as well. This is a lot of words. Sorry, folks.
Oh, I guess the end would be paradise.
Yeah, you know, I guess maybe,
like,
yeah.
The means to the end, which would be to meet God, like, you know, or to be in the vicinity, the space, the
feel
the
God,
field,
I don't know,
you know, to not be suffering.
Whatever,
like,
whatever's beyond this life.
Essentially.
Sure, but
you know,
I think we're only, but I don't think we can really talk about the next life right now.
Why not?
Oh, I don't know if we can imagine it or even begin to conceptualize it.
Oh, that's what you mean.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Girl, I go back to the Quran and I read the Quran and I'm like, okay, so heavenly thrones, gold thrones, we'll have all of the things, the drinks that we like, you know, I'm out here reading gardens with streams flowing in it. Look, I'm envisioning, okay? I go into the Quran and I read those passages and I am envisioning. I said, okay.
You're manifesting.
I'm manifesting. I pray, God, please let me into heaven. I can't do hell. Please let me into heaven. I pray about it so much. I'm telling you. So, of course, I think about it all the time. I think about it all the time. I'm like, God,
okay.
Paradise is on my mind, okay?
Because, like, I remember, Taylor, we were having this conversation kind of, or a similar conversation earlier, where we were talking about, like, maybe God and feeling God in heaven and the afterlife or whatever is so beyond our capacities to even, like,
God.
Yeah, like, how can we conceptualize God?
I can't conceptualize God.
Exactly.
This was what I was thinking when we were discussing this. I can't conceptualize God. Actually, I try to, and I think of all the different ways, and I'm like, I can't, my brain. But heaven, heaven is a different story.
Okay, I guess.
You know what? My limited capacity is trying to picture myself. Okay, who knows what my body will look like, my soul, my spirit, who knows? But I am going back to those words.
Yeah.
And I'm praying that God helps me manifest this.
Yeah. No, fair.
But I did want to talk about something that Elias mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a note here because I knew I would probably forget. So protest as a replacement for the concept of the masjid.
Mm-hmm.
And this brought me back to church and the argument of church a lot. So I'll go through that.
Just before you continue, I'm so sorry I interrupted you. For listeners who may be new here, Taylor used to be Catholic.
Yeah. So I was raised Catholic. My whole family's Catholic. I'm a convert, revert. So my perspective is definitely different to yours as a person who was raised Muslim and grew up Muslim. So a lot of my experiences are in the context of the church and Catholicism and Christianity in general. So I was thinking about this because Catholics, strict ones, will tell you, you have to go to church, this is what a church is, this is what it looks like, it has a priest, this is what you need to have the sacraments, et cetera, et cetera. Christians who are, you know, tend to be, you know, various kinds of Christians will stretch that definition of church that doesn't necessarily include these formal sacraments, but is still a gathering place.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thinking about how church, you know, oftentimes people, Christians, will associate church as a gathering place for God, for praise and worship of God. And here's my disclaimer. I have actually never been to a masjid. I had the opportunity to go in grade 11 in my world religions class, but I had to go skip school to get one of my shots that day. And I never got a chance to visit a masjid, a mosque. So I am a Muslim talking about an experience that I've never had. So please, this is also why I frame it in the context of church, because I've never gathered in a space with, you know, I am a COVID Muslim, you know, I haven't gathered in a space with tens of hundreds, possibly other Muslims praying. So in person, so God willing in the future. But I loved how Elias connected protest to as a form of, you know, the connection that mm-hmm. you find in the masjid mm-hmm. and why that rang all the bells for me in terms of church is because exactly what we've been talking about, the work that you have to do, that we believe that we are required to do as Muslims, which is the community, the activism, the advocacy, that work I think of as praise. Mm-hmm. You know, I think of it very much every time I wear hijab, people will ask me why I decided to wear hijab. And I tell them I wear hijab for myself because it reminds me of my duty to God and thus to myself. So what kind of person am I meant to be? How am I supposed to act? When I see myself or I see my reflection or I feel my scarf, my headscarf on my body, that is a physical reminder for me of that action, of the actions I do as praiseworthy of God, you know? And so when I think of protest and that kind of community action, mm-hmm. that coming together, it for me very much makes it like in my brain, I'm like church, 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 you know, like that is what a church is. It's your coming together to build up other people in the praise of God. And so mm-hmm. even if, you know, you're not at a Muslim-based protest, or you're not at a protest where other people are talking about God, I still read that action, just like when I'm walking down the street and I'm trying not to judge somebody because I'm Muslim, and I remember that because I have my hijab on, I read those actions as giving God the glory, you know? Like, I am someone who has been asked, has been designated upon me to praise God through God's creations, through my actions, through my words, through my thoughts. And so I love that. I love, love, love thinking about that in the context of a protest, in the context of a community gathering that is meant to bring justice, right? Mm. Is meant to celebrate something that is inherently valuable because it was created mm-hmm. by God, you know? Yeah,
and that's why we have to work to like dismantle the shitty systems that we live in that, you know, prioritize the dictate who gets to live and who gets to die.
Yeah,
because that's not on us mm-hmm. to decide, mm-hmm. but people have taken it upon themselves to, you know, create to be white supremacists, to enact white supremacy, to colonize, to, you know, be fucked up and shit, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And like, I guess something I was saying earlier in the podcast or in our conversation was like thinking about queer Muslim resistance as like the conditions we need to feel joy. Mm-hmm. And like,
I love that.
Thank you.
I love that.
Thanks. Let me, yeah. So how can we create moments of joy where we are and also do things that mean that this joy is accessible mm-hmm. and can be felt by everyone? Mm-hmm. That means, hopefully we've been able to like really hone in on this podcast so far, but like we really, really mean like working with like a framework of radical love where we are thinking anti-colonial, decolonial action,
abolitionist,
anti-state, anti-capitalist. For real, like what, like I hope we've tried to make clear like that our responsibility to each other is an act of radical love.
Mm-hmm.
And like our politics are that of like working in everyone's interests and not like deciding things for people, but working towards a world in which everyone is able to make decisions for themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. Free from inequity, inequality, well,
mm-hmm.
and burden,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
Inequality, really, and burden. And, you know, I think if we think about the fact that as Muslims, this is what we are called to do, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, that God, the merciful, the embodied, the, well, not embodied, but our, any idea of mercy that we have and compassion that we have is surpassed by what God has for us.
Mm-hmm.
If you start with that, you know,
yeah.
it's so clear. It is so clear what we are called to do. Like, it is so clear,
yeah.
you know? And so if you model, if you try to model, and if we as Muslims truly try to model that through love and through action that is loving, it means caring for every single human being. It means
mm-hmm.
caring for every being. It means caring for our planet. It means
mm-hmm.
caring for, you know what I mean? Like, and so that's the joyful part of it. Like the love, it's work, but it is also, it's resistance. That's the work part. But it's also so joyful because it's what our God is for us,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And because it is what God is for us and to us every day, it's what we try to do and be for ourselves
mm-hmm.
and for each other on earth.
Yeah, and that links back to what we've talked about like previously in different episodes about like the concept of radical love being God consciousness.
Yeah
right,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And that's why God always, that's why God always comes to me when I think about our community work, you know, the protest, that space of community that we do together, you
mm-hmm.
know. And that's also maybe why Zakat, the possibility of Zakat as not just money,
mm-hmm.
but rather
intention,
meaning, I should say, something that's meaningful,
mm-hmm.
an action that is meaningful, and isn't just
yeah.
meant to perpetuate systems of power.
Yeah.
Doing that together with a whole bunch of other Muslims,
mm-hmm.
you know, that and non-Muslims, like the action itself, the communal action,
mm-hmm.
that is just
mm-hmm.
like that brings me joy, you
mm-hmm.
know. It makes me so happy. So and at the, maybe just to come full circle, this is why I feel so happy listening to people like Elias and all the other people we've had on this podcast who reiterate versions of my politics and versions of Islam that I have and that I try to enact in another part of the world, somewhere I've never been, you know, people who I've never seen, you know, it's cool. It makes me feel like, oh, you know, the kids are all right. Like we're getting there,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah, because it can feel so isolating at times.
Yeah, it can feel very isolating.
Yeah.
Especially when you're thinking about it in a framework of being Muslim,
mm-hmm.
you know, because none of these ideas are new. Like,
no,
we are not revolutionaries in thought. We are quite literally reiterating what we read, which is
yeah.
what
Quran,
we
read and what we see,
read, what we see,
what
we know,
hear,
which is from
what
other
we
people,
learn from other people,
and from
exactly.
our God. Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, thanks for listening, folks. That's all we have for you tonight.
Yeah, thanks. Tune in for a quick outro said by me.
Tune in. Outro here.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Queer Muslim Resistance. This would not be possible without the help of our lovely volunteer, Aram, so thank you endlessly for your time and support. We really, really, really appreciate you. As always, you can find relevant links in the episode description. Make sure to check us out on Instagram for links to our Queer Muslim resource guide and for awesome Queer Muslim and other content in general. You can email us at queermuslimresistance@gmail.com for any inquiries, additional resources you'd like to see added to the resource guide, or just to say hi.